Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. As many of you know, I recently lost my dad to a rare and aggressive form of prostate cancer. Over the past few weeks, we've been discussing grief and cancer, and the response to these shows has been incredible. Today, we are talking about a very related issue, caregiving. I moved in with my dad for 3 months after he got his diagnosis in May, and again after we called hospice in November. This was not my first time caring for my parents, but nothing could have prepared me for caring for my dad while he was bedridden and in hospice. My brother and I found ourselves making decisions we never could have imagined, like determining how much medication our dad should receive. I didn't even know that we would be making these decisions. We faced the gut-wrenching decision to increase his morphine dosage to ease his pain, but doing this meant we would never talk to him again. Today's guest, Dr. Ann Applebaum, also cared for her father, Stan Applebaum, for a decade. Even though she's a caregiving scientist, she was struck by the profound challenges she faced. She also performed medical and nursing tasks and acted as her dad's case manager. She says navigating the complexities of Medicaid and home care were even more complicated than getting her doctorate. Dr. Allison Applebaum writes about her experience in her beautiful book of narrative nonfiction, Stand By Me, A Guide to Navigating Modern Meaningful Caregiving. Stand By Me blends practical advice with personal reflections on the deeply emotional journey of caregiving. Stand By Me also carries forward Dr. Allison Applebaum's dad's legacy. Stan Applebaum was a world-renowned composer, arranger, musician, and conductor. He arranged and conducted many hit songs, including the arrangement for Benny King's Stand By Me. Dr. Allison Applebaum is a caregiving scientist whose primary focus is on developing innovative approaches to meeting the urgent needs of family caregivers, that is, family members and friends of patients with chronic or life-limiting illnesses who serve a critical and often unrecognized role on the healthcare team. Dr. Allison Applebaum is professor of geriatrics and palliative medicine and director of the Center for Caregiving at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She was previously director of the Caregivers Clinic at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the first program of its kind in the country to provide comprehensive psychosocial care to family members and friends of patients who are in the caregiving role. Dr. Applebaum's Stand By Me book is narrative nonfiction, and it was just released in paperback. Hi, Dr. Applebaum. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here this morning.
Well, it's great to have you. Your dad, Stan, passed away 5 years ago on February 23rd, 2019. What is it like to still be sharing his story so publicly 5 years after he passed?
Yeah, and obviously, so today's the 25th, so 26th, so just a few days ago was the anniversary of his death. You know, the wound is still there. The pain is still sharp. My dad and I were best friends. We had an incredibly warm and open emotionally and vulnerable relationship. And, when I was taking care of him, my life in so many ways orbited around him. And after his death, so much shifted. And so it's been quite a journey since his death in 2019. And I'll say that sharing his story right now and carrying forward his legacy remains one of the ways that I continue to grieve. And as we all grieve, it's one way in which we can continue to maintain a connection to the person who's no longer here. So the pain is still quite sharp. Changed form a little bit over the past few years, though.
You know, what I have found is sharing information about my dad, Dan, has just been so helpful. And rather than just say my dad passed, which is what I did in the beginning, just felt empty. but sharing information about him and actually naming him has made me feel better. And I was so touched in your book because you did the same thing. Your dad was so accomplished. I know so many of the songs that he arranged, and I'm sure most of our listeners do. But you also talk about what he was like as a father, and it's so beautiful. You write that what resulted in your relationship was the most intensely loving, supportive, and honest relationship you could imagine unfolding between a father and daughter. And you also talk about how your dad was almost 60 when you came into the picture in November of 1981, and this dramatically shaped your life. You write that you feared his death from the day you learned that he was 70 when you were just 10. So can you talk about that? Talk about the importance of, you know, letting people know what a world-renowned composer and conductor your dad was, but also that he was such an amazing, loving dad.
Yeah, I love this question because this is so much of what motivated me when I began writing Stand By Me. And I opened the book talking about one of what I see as the primary responsibilities we have as caregivers when we're actively taking care of someone, and that is to convey our care partner's personhood, who they are as a human, what their values are, what makes them tick. And since my dad's death, it's been equally important for me as it is for you, Rose, to share who Stan Applebaum was in this world, and not just who he was as a musician and as a composer and an orchestrator and an arranger and what he did by profession, but who he was as a human, who he was in his soul. My dad was incredibly creative, incredibly curious. This was a man who never wanted to stop learning or growing. He never retired. Like many great artists, he was never going to retire. He continued to write music from his hospital bed. I have some videos of him conducting from his hospital bed. This was a man who at age 103 this week, age 92, forgive me. At 92, he chose to learn Tagalog, the language of his home health aides, because he wanted to challenge himself. And he wanted to communicate with them in their native language. And these were some of the most important things when I was taking care of him for me to convey to his healthcare team members so that they knew who Stan Applebaum was, not just because he was this great musician, but because this was a man who had goals and a drive for life. And now that he's no longer here, it's almost more important for me as I speak about him to share these other sides of who he was, not just that he was so accomplished and so talented in his musical work, but that he was an incredibly talented father. As you mentioned, my dad had me later in life. He was nearly 60 when I came into the picture, and that very much shaped my experience. I mean, there wasn't a day in my life between that day that I learned he was 70 when I was 10 until the day he died in 2019 that I didn't fear his death. And yet that fear really engendered within me a deep appreciation for the moment, for every moment that I had with him. And ultimately, it made it that we lived each moment as if it was going to be our last.
You also brought up something that I hadn't thought about because my dad was only 74 when he passed. And he just loved to talk. I mean, he made everyone laugh. In the hospital room, he would play his heavy metal and he had the nurses dancing and headbanging in his room. I just got a card from the cancer center. And, you know, while some people just said, I'm sorry for your loss, a number of people wrote lengthy messages saying, I will miss your dad's humor. He was so kind. He made other patients laugh. And he had so much life. He had he was obviously very young. And it was so interesting to learn about what you had to do with your dad. And it seems to me that your dad faced some ageism in the hospital. And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's what I got from what you shared. Because you talk about how you had to advocate every time you ended up in the ER with your dad. You showed healthcare providers timestamp pictures and videos from the days leading up to the ER visit, such as your dad talking about articles from the Tuesday Science Times he recently read. You wanted your providers to actually meet your dad. So can you talk about that every time you went to the hospital, you wanted them to know that he was more than a number?
100%, 100%. So it became very clear to me, and I just want to say, so my dad had Lewy body disease, which is a progressive neurodegenerative disease. It leads to fluctuations in what we call autonomic functioning and consciousness. And for him, he would have some sudden drops in blood pressure and temperature. And most prominently, he would hallucinate. And he would hallucinate anywhere from a few minutes to a few hours. Occasionally, he'd hallucinate an entire day, and one time an entire week. And when he was hallucinating, when he was disoriented, he wasn't able to engage meaningfully in conversation with myself or anyone else. And the hallucinations, while we eventually got them well controlled with medication, were often very much brought on by dehydration, a urinary tract infection, or any of the other ailments that older adults have. And I share this because every time I brought my dad to the hospital, he was not in great shape, right? We don't bring folks to the hospital when they feel well. He was often hallucinating, or he was just not awake or aware. And that meant it became very clear to me from the start of our illness journey together, which was 2013, that without me by his side to serve as his eyes and ears and voice, there would have been no way for any members of his PASI medical teams to have any idea who Stan Applebaum was and what mattered to him. And we faced this double whammy, what I would say, both ageism, which was very, very prominent, as well as some bias because of his cognitive status. So, you know, the fact that my dad's date of birth on his wristband was listed as 1922 for sure shaped the opinions and the treatment that we received by many, many healthcare professionals. It felt like I was combating ageism from the start of our journey. And there were many experiences we had, one of which was my dad was set to have a very simple procedure to have what is called a suprapubic catheter inserted into his bladder. This is a tube that would assist with urination and ultimately was going to protect him against urinary tract infections, would protect him from having to have a very uncomfortable Foley catheter. And so the idea of this catheter being inserted into his bladder was actually going to improve his quality of life. And yet I will never forget the day a doctor took me outside the room and said, "Ms. Applebaum, what are you doing having your dad have this procedure? He's in his 90s. And he said, if my dad was in his 90s, he wouldn't have this procedure. That was the most overt example of ageism. But ultimately, you know, we experienced many, many moments where it felt like the value of my dad's life was being questioned because he was a man in his 90s. And because he was also, when I brought him in, often cognitively compromised, it felt to me like I was, by showing the timestamp videos, doing all I could to convey who Stan Applebaum was, that I was trying to convince those members of his healthcare teams that what they saw in front of them was not my dad's permanent lived reality. I mean, the reality is that there were many occasions where he would come down with a urinary tract infection, and when I brought him to the hospital, he couldn't speak. But 2 days before, would be having a very complicated intellectual conversation with me, one that some of my colleagues might not have even been able to follow. And so it felt like I was fighting against these biases and trying to convince all of these healthcare professionals that Stan Applebaum's life mattered. You know, and the other thing that came up for me and for my dad is conveying that what we believe quality of life to be is very personal and unique to each one of us. So during this period, my dad was primarily bedbound or chair bound. He was not able to walk on his own. We had a lot of assistance. We needed a lot of assistance. But for him, quality of life meant being able to have meaningful conversations. It meant being able to enjoy his favorite meal or sitting outside in the sunshine. And I think that it was so challenging for us to convey that, yeah, he wasn't going to be walking down the street on his own, but that doesn't mean that the life he could be living in the future wasn't going to be meaningful.
Exactly. And then to add another layer to that, you write that from 2013 until your dad's death in 2019, you were given drastically conflicting information about his prognosis based on the specialist with whom you spoke. So the neurologist, the primary care doctor, the hospital intensivist versus the geriatrician. Yeah. I mean, there's just so much information coming at you at once. Yeah. And you have to process and make sense of all of that.
Yeah. You know, one thing you shared when you opened with your story is that the ways in which we as family caregivers become critical members of the healthcare team.
Yeah.
We are asked to tease apart incredibly complex medical information. And just for listeners, I'm a clinical psychologist by training. I certainly believe I got my honorary MD and nursing degree by taking care of my dad, as I imagine you, Rose, have as well. But I didn't have any formalized training in medicine. And I was really forced in many situations, not only to provide medical care to my dad, but to tease apart a lot of complicated information and make decisions based on a lot of different and conflicting information that we were getting, which is very, very difficult. And I should just say, it's for any caregivers listening, this is one of the primary drivers of distress, the amount of responsibilities we have in terms of the medical and nursing tasks we take on and the decision-making we need to make, especially in the context of complicated medical information.
I think that if I hadn't gone through this experience, I would have been surprised when you talk about and write about how navigating the complexities of Medicaid and home care were more complicated than getting your doctorate. But now I completely understand what you mean by that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think my whole journey, and you hit it on the head as you opened, but what was so striking to me, here I was a healthcare professional working. I was on faculty at two hospitals, one of which was where my dad was primarily getting his care. You know, I'm highly educated. I have support. I have health insurance. I have colleagues who want to help. And yet, to me, navigating the healthcare system was excruciatingly difficult. And it just made me realize, if it's so difficult for me, what is it like for most folks who don't have the training and the experience and the network that I have? And it's a really daunting thought, quite frankly.
Right. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Allison Applebaum, a caregiving scientist who's author of the narrative nonfiction book Stand By Me, A Guide to Navigating Modern Meaningful Caregiving. It was just released in paperback. Dr. Applebaum is professor of geriatrics and palliative medicine and director of the Center for Caregiving at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She was previously director of the Caregivers Clinic at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the first program of its kind in the U.S. to provide comprehensive psychosocial care to family members and friends of patients who are in the caregiving role. That now serves as a model for cancer centers across the country. If you'd like to join us, if you have a caregiving story to share, we'd love to hear from you. And if you have been a caregiver or you are a caregiver, what resources would you like to see? What sort of policies would you like to see to support you and your loved ones? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. If you'd like to also talk about how it impacted your health and overall well-being, if you have any tips for people who have not been through it yet, you can call us at 866-798-8255 or email your call at kalw.org. In your book, Stand By Me, you write, "Not once as my dad's caregiver was I ever given professional guidance in navigating these conversations, though I certainly wish that I had been." And I've been thinking about this a lot because my parents are young. They live on their own. I wasn't really prepared for it. Everybody, when I would talk about caregiving, people would say, "Oh yeah, I went through it too." And I'd say, "How old were your parents?" And they'd say, "In the 90s. And I'd say, "Well, mine are in their early 70s. So I still, to this day, Dr. Applebaum, I just don't know how I could have been better prepared. I don't think I would have signed up for a class. I mean, I'm lucky because I do shows about this, so this was not new. But what are your thoughts about what that should look like for people who just don't, they don't know when it's coming.
Of course. Yeah. And I look back, hindsight is always 20/20. My mother was actually 22 years younger than my father, and she actually died very suddenly a year after my dad's diagnosis. And so I've had these two experiences of both going through sudden loss with a parent who was younger, and then this drawn out period of decline and death with my father. And collectively with these two experiences, what it really did for me is highlighted the conversations I wish I had had long before either of them got sick, or in the case of my mother, her death. And I think that the conversations I wish I had had are conversations that are uncomfortable because they draw an elephant into the room. And of course, that elephant is death. And we don't like to talk about death. It's not something we're comfortable talking about. It's not part of our narrative when you grow up, at least here in the United States. We don't like to talk about it. But I wish that I had talked to both of my parents, for example, about what their goals of healthcare might be should there come a time in the future when, you know, they would be more physically or cognitively limited. I wish, and this is very important, I wish I had talked to my parents about the financial resources they had or did not have that could potentially pay for medical care or home health care or any of their needs in the future. I think these are conversations that we should all be having yesterday. These are conversations we should all have ideally when we're all healthy, when we are healthy, when our parents are healthy, because these are conversations that get a bit more difficult when there's crisis, when there's urgency to make decisions. And quite frankly, the other thing to say is that I don't look at these as static conversations, as conversations that happen once. My goal when I talk about this is to encourage folks to open a conversation that is going to then become a dialogue you have over the course of years. And it's going to morph and change. But the more open you can be with your family members, your blood or chosen family members now, it's going to make it easier down the line should there be a situation where you step into a caregiving role, because you will have already established that openness.
What would you say to people whose parents might not be open to those conversations?
Yeah. So two thoughts on that. Number one, and I see this often, I've seen it often in my clinical practice, where patients and caregivers walk around in what I call a network of silence. And that is where a caregiver avoids talking about a certain topic because they don't want to upset the patient, and then the patient's doing the same thing. But ultimately, deep down, they're both worried about the same thing. They both actually want to talk about the elephant in the room. And so in many cases, we as adult children make an assumption, because our parents are not bringing the topic up, that they don't want to talk about it. So I just want to point that out for listeners, that it's actually quite possible that just because your parents have not brought up the future, their healthcare needs, goals of care in the future, that doesn't mean they don't necessarily want to talk about it. It's possible they're actually trying to protect you. And so the best thing that you can do is bring up the conversation, because then it gives them permission to then talk about it. Now, if you do so and your parent says, I don't want to talk about this, you know, they're resistant, you can say, that's fine, Mom. This is so important to me. I'm going to ask you again in about 6 months. Is that okay? And you can just start to nudge them to open the conversation.
Right.
And then if eventually they're not open to talking about it with you, you can inquire, is there anyone right now in our circle with whom you'd be comfortable speaking? Maybe it's your sibling. Maybe is it your lawyer? Maybe it's your physician. Is there someone else? Maybe it's not me. But I do think this is an important conversation to be had.
Because dealing with the will, the power of attorney, all of the financial issues, doing that while a parent is sick is very, very difficult.
Yeah. It's very complicated. I mean, first of all, you know, based on what the challenges are your parent is facing, whether they are cognitive challenges like my dad or physical challenges, they may not be able actually literally to make the best decisions or make decisions that reflect their values. And so that's one thing to keep in mind. But also, these are decisions like who steps into the healthcare proxy role, who steps into the power of attorney role, that often require discussions among family members, especially, for example, if there are two adult children. How are decisions being made about who's going to step into these roles? And I just want to say, because I always use this as an education moment, because I don't know that everyone knows the difference between these two. I just want to clarify But the healthcare proxy role, this is the individual who's going to eventually serve as the voice for the patient. Should there come a time when that individual is unable to speak on their own behalf in the setting of healthcare decisions? So I was my dad's healthcare proxy after my mother's death. I brought his voice into the room in the hospital. That is different from the power of attorney, the individual who's going to make financial decisions on behalf of the patient, should they not be able to. Now, often it's the same person. I was the same for my father. I was both. But it's not always the case, especially when there's multiple adult children in the family.
Right. And then to add another layer on that, there's all of the documents. Where's the title? If your parent owns a home, where's the title of the house? Has a will been done? Where's the title of the car? My dad was fantastic because he got his will done about 4 years before all of this happened, but I didn't know where it was. And I actually found it kind of crumbled in a drawer. So it's just these things are so important to get out on the table and talk about.
Absolutely. It's actually, I've had a similar experience where I found these two envelopes that my dad put together, and the envelopes rows were labeled for when I die. Mm. And one of the envelopes was put together in the 90s, and one of them was put together around 2010. And none of the information in these envelopes was actually helpful to me in 2019. Wow. And it's a good thing that I didn't depend on finding such envelopes that he and I actually had conversations. But at the time that my mom died, we realized that the only will that my dad had was outdated by 20 years. Mm-hmm. And so we actually needed to re-execute a will upon my mother's death in 2014. And so, yeah, these are conversations. It is, and just exactly where do these documents live? Are they in a safe? Are they in the home? Who has access, et cetera, et cetera? And again, these are conversations that are much easier to have and much more productive to have when you're not urgently trying to find the documents.
Right. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Allison Applebaum, a caregiving scientist whose primary focus is on developing approaches to meeting the urgent needs of family caregivers. She's author of the book, Stand By Me, A Guide to Navigating Modern Meaningful Caregiving. It was just released in paperback. Dr. Applebaum is professor of geriatrics and palliative medicine and director of the Center for Caregiving at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She was previously director of the Caregivers Clinic at the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the first program of its kind in the U.S. to provide comprehensive psychosocial care to family members and friends of patients who are in the caregiving role. This now serves as a model for cancer centers nationally. If you'd like to join us, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series on cancer by speaking with Dr. Anne Pittier, a radiation oncologist in Washington State who's passionate about the treatment of breast and gynecologic cancers. She points to the fact that a healthy diet and lifestyle behaviors could prevent 40% of cancer cases, according to the American Institute for Cancer Research. We hope you can join us for that show tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Dr. Allison Applebaum. She is a caregiving scientist who wrote a book, Stand By Me, A Guide to Navigating Modern Meaningful Caregiving. It's partly about her experience taking care of her dad, Stan Applebaum. He was a world-renowned composer, arranger, musician, and conductor. He arranged and conducted many hit songs, including the arrangement for Benny King's Stand By Me. Dr. Allison Applebaum is professor of geriatrics and palliative medicine and director of the Center for Caregiving at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. If you have any questions or comments about caregiving, if you'd like to share a personal experience, if you have ever been a caregiver, how has it impacted your health and overall well-being? What sort of policies would you like to see for caregivers? We have a few callers on the line, so let's go to Lynn in Menlo Park. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Oh, okay. So I'm in my 70s and my husband is in his 80s. And we've always had a will and a, you know, healthcare proxy, and we have a power of attorney. We have two adult children, but we wanted to take it a step further. And I encouraged my husband for us to make an appointment and take care of what's going to happen to us after that day happens. So we're now cardholding members of the Neptune Society of Northern California, and it feels great.
What is the Neptune Society?
It's a society that's been around for about, it's been here back in the 70s it started. And you meet with a funeral director and you arrange, what we did was our cremation and what we want done with our ashes. And now our children don't have to make that decision. And they just have to make one call. And the Neptune Society works all throughout the United States and Canada. And if that day comes or happens when you're in Europe or traveling abroad, there's an insurance policy set up. So everything is all taken care of financially, and our wishes will be honored.
Wow. Thank you so much for calling in, Lynn, and telling us about the Neptune Society. This reminds me of the conversations that my brother and I had with my dad about this very issue. We thought it would be too hard for each other. And so we both had conversations on our own with our dad. Mm. And it was such a surreal and difficult conversation. And you're just bringing me back to that. And it's so important, though, to talk about, Lynn. So thank you for bringing this up. What are your thoughts about this, Dr. Applebaum? I'm so glad that something like this exists, the Neptune Society of Northern California. And this is another element that is very difficult to talk about, but so important.
Oh my gosh, Lynn, what a gift that you've given to your children. Truly, it's incredible that you've been able to take this off their shoulders. It's so overwhelming for those of us who go through the loss to then have to scramble and figure out what in the world would mom or dad want to do. And that was the case when my mom died suddenly. I had to very quickly scramble and buy a cemetery plot, et cetera, et cetera. And I would say that this topic falls into the category of the conversations that I encourage all caregivers to be having with care partners. This is not the first conversation you certainly will be having. I said earlier, what's important is that you open a dialogue that's going to basically continue over time. And over time, hopefully with repeated conversations, there's going to be a greater level of comfort between you and your care partner that's going to make it more palatable to eventually discuss wishes for after death. And quite frankly, most individuals, most patients do have some ideas about what they want or what they don't want. It was really important for me to learn that my dad, for him, it was really important that he had a military funeral, that he had a military salute. My dad was a World War II veteran. And the most important thing that he shared with me was that he did have that salute at his funeral. And I actually was not aware that that was the most important thing until I asked him. So I'm so grateful that I did. Mm-hmm. And I think that these are conversations when you open up, you know, do you have any thoughts about what you would like for us to do? I mean, I think that just opens a lot of different avenues for discussion, both in terms of what a parent wants for their actual funeral or burial or cremation or whatever their goals are, but also what are their goals for you after they're gone? What are their goals for how they want you to maybe carry forward their legacy? I mean, talking to my dad about his potential funeral, his eventual funeral, and we actually talked about his obituary. I actually wanted him to help me write his obituary. It gave him the opportunity to start to share with me the goals he had for my life after he was no longer going to be here. So it really actually ended up being quite a gift.
That's so beautiful. And I will share, and it's amazing how time does heal, because there's no way I could have talked about this last week without really crying. But our dad said he did not want anything somber. He did not want people wearing black. He wanted everyone to wear their favorite sports shirt, and he wanted it at his friend's restaurant in Petaluma. And I mean, it was so amazing. We had his favorite music blaring and everybody was wearing sports shirts. Over 350 people showed up. It was incredible. I know he was smiling down on us. And
that's amazing.
That was such a hard conversation to have, but it's exactly what he would have wanted. And I mean, again, it's so devastating, but this is going to happen. And it's so important to have these discussions, so it's not completely stressful. So yeah, thank you. You just brought up a really warm, these memories are now warm. They're not as devastating as they were even a week ago. Do you find that, Dr. Applebaum? Everybody has different experiences, but given that you have worked with so many caregivers, the process afterwards, I mean, everyone's journey is different, and we've been doing these shows about grief, but it's just been such a gift to be able to talk about this on the air and to hear so many people's stories.
Yeah. Well, I just want to say I'm grateful you are talking about grief, because again, that elephant in the room, when you talk about it, you're giving everyone else permission to talk about it. I know there's many listeners who are taking an exhale because they want to talk about it and they feel heard and seen through what you're sharing. So thank you for that. You're right. There is no one trajectory for grief, because how we grieve is very personal and very unique to each one of us. And so often patients will ask me, how should I be feeling 8 months later? How should I be feeling 2 years later? And the answer is actually, there is no answer to that. It's really, how were you last month? And let's talk about, you know, where you are in your own personal trajectory. I will say for many caregivers, there is this experience that you've articulated where initially the pain is so sharp that it overpowers memories. But as time goes on, we are better able to reconnect to memories with sweetness and joy. I mean, when my dad's picture shows up on my iPhone, I just light up. Anybody who spends time with me, you know when my dad's picture comes up, because I just light up. Mm. And thinking about him and talking about him makes me feel that joy that we had when he was here. And I want to acknowledge when I say that, that that joy in seeing his face lives concurrently with grief. And I think that's really important for me to emphasize, that as we move through grief, that we can also have even brief moments of joy or feel warmth or love as we think about the person who's no longer here. It doesn't mean we're not grieving. It just means we're able to reconnect to the good stuff that was there when they were here with us. Mm.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Thank you. Thank you again for calling in, Lynn. Let's go next to Susan in Stanford. Hi, Susan. Thank you for holding.
Oh, good morning. And thank you for taking my call. I having these conversations in some strange way allows the person who's dying to give a gift to both of you. I mean, it sounds like, you know, knowing what they wanted was very helpful and it was a way of taking care of you. But I have a different issue that I wanted to bring up in terms of discussing matters that are important with my adult children. I am the one who brings it up, and they are the ones who don't want to talk about it. Mm. So I wondered what your thoughts would be, Dr. Amy, you know, what suggestions you might have in terms I've given them the Gawande book, Being Mortal. I've tried to convince them that I am mortal. And and I see the tears, especially in my daughter's eyes, you know, that she can't believe a world without me being in it, you know, and so thoughts appreciated. Yeah. Thank you very
well,
much.
Thank you so much for this question. I think this is a really common experience. So the fact that your daughter tears up even at this suggestion of talking about this really exemplifies the intensity of her love for you. And of course, her intense fear at the idea of you not being here at some point in the future. I think that we often as humans we engage in what we would call magical thinking. If we talk about a certain thing, it's going to happen sooner. If we were to talk about death or a decline in health, that death or decline in health would happen sooner. And we know that's not the case. In fact, we know that it's the opposite, that when we actually talk about those elephants in the room, that it eventually lowers our anxiety and actually would alleviate some of the intensity of your daughter's sadness. But we can't push her if she's not ready. And so one thing I would encourage you to do, if she finds it too overwhelming to have that conversation in real time with you, is maybe to write her a letter and write out the main things that you want to talk to her about and why, and ask her maybe to share with you in some way that she's comfortable sharing, what would help her to engage in this conversation. Let her lead you a little bit in terms of what she might need from you. I do have throughout my book, by the way, a lot of very concrete communication tips and strategies to help patients and caregivers to engage in some of these conversations. So I hope the book may be helpful to her as well. But we can't force somebody to talk to us about something they're not ready to talk to us about. But I do think over time that readiness will happen. And if you can't have a real-time conversation, I would encourage you to write it out. A lot of the patients with whom I've worked have found that to be quite helpful as a way to open it. The other thing I'll say is, you know, I'm a clinical psychologist by training, and just because I've had all these years of training as a psychologist, having these conversations with my dad were very difficult. These are hard conversations, and oftentimes they are conversations that can be better navigated with somebody helping to mediate, like a psychologist or a social worker. You may find it helpful to actually have what we would call a family meeting with a mental health professional to help the two of you or the three of you to have this conversation. So that might be another way to navigate this in the future.
Well, thank you for calling in, Susan, and I hope that helps. Again, Dr. Allison Applebaum's book is called Stand By Me, A Guide to Navigating Modern Meaningful Caregiving. It was just released in paperback, and thank you so much for calling. Let's go next to Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I wanted to, when I heard the woman talking about the Neptune Society, it made me think of four different options, actually. My parents did sign up with the Neptune Society many, many years before their death, and it was really a relief because those people just came, took my parents' bodies, did exactly what we wished. You know, my parents told us, said, you know, we just want a scattering, but whatever you want is most important. And my sister said she wanted some remains, so they did a partial scattering and sent us some remains. Then a couple of years ago, my really dear, beautiful friend died, the one who actually helped take care of my parents when they were in their last year. And what we chose for her friends, you know, she was actually an undocumented immigrant, so didn't have any family here. What we chose for her was something called recomposing. Well, it's composting the body, which is now legal in 6 states, I believe, but it's not activated in California yet. It was going to take about 7 years to get it, you know, able to go. So there are some places up in Washington, I think, is the closest place, and that's what we did, which is just a beautiful place. You know, the organization that does it, there are a couple of them up there. They're both very respectful, very aesthetic about it.
Go ahead, Judy.
I just have 2 more I'll tell you about. I can tell you quickly if you're in a hurry. For me, I chose the Willed Body Program because I don't have any kids. I don't have anyone to really do this for me. And the Willed Body Program is where I donate my body to UCSF for study, and they take it and they do not give it back. So if you choose organ donation, like on your license, your family will get the body back. And if you don't want that, you can use the Willed Body Program. And that's about all I have to say. You know, because I have no kids, I have, you know, other people, another person, a nice person who lives near me who's going to take care of this, but I want to make it easy for her. And, of course, I wish there was long-term care in Medicare.
Yes. You know? Well, thank you for those points, Judy. And there's a lot there. To the point about not having kids, I want to make sure we get this question in from Wendy, who writes, I cared for my elderly parents and I advocated for them. I am one of the millions of older people who do not have children. I don't have a partner or any family. So who will advocate for me? This is terrifying to think that I will at some point need medical care and need someone to advocate for me, and I don't have anyone. What will happen to us? Dr. Applebaum, is this an issue that gets much attention? I feel like I just don't read much about it.
It doesn't, and Wendy, I'm so grateful. I'm so grateful that you shared this question. There are a very large number of adults and older adults who do not have children or other close family who they feel comfortable asking or will serve as a healthcare proxy or power of attorney. And it can be really overwhelming, really scary, and really isolating. What I would encourage you to do is to consider, is there anyone in your social support network, any friend that you have, anyone from any of the communities that you are a part of who you feel a closeness with, and you might consider asking for them to step up? And of course, it's not the same as having an adult child or someone else who is an obvious pick and who would most likely, you know, say yes to that. But I would encourage you to think creatively and flexibly about who is in your network. And more older adults need to do that.
Well, this is really important, Wendy. We'll definitely do a show about this. And then thank you for bringing up telehealth and potential cuts to Medicaid. We will definitely do shows about that. We have an email from Susan who writes, I have made arrangements for my body to be donated to the UC Medical Center in San Francisco. It's not difficult to do, and I've shared this information with my adult children. An advanced healthcare directive can include what you want your celebration of life or funeral to be like. I learned all of this 6 years ago when my husband of 41 years died after suffering with cancer for 7 months, and we didn't have much in place. This experience taught me that I could help my wonderful family by preparing more thoroughly. I miss my husband every day, who was an extraordinary individual. My family, friends, and I include him in our daily conversations and activities. Susan, thank you for the email. I'm so sorry to hear about your husband. And thank you for sharing this. It's another example, Dr. Applebaum, of something happening in a family that makes you think, oh, I really need to take action now.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think, again, I'll go back to that the best time to have all these conversations and to take action is yesterday, that we never know when someone is going to get sick. We don't know if somebody is going to have a sudden medical event. And it's best to just be prepared. And maybe today's show is that kick in the ass that you need to think about opening that conversation. You know, I'll also say that I know that opening to these types of conversations can be so overwhelming. It can be really helpful to practice them in advance, practice them out loud to a friend, to a therapist, to someone else in your life before you actually open the conversation with someone, with a care partner. And that might make it even easier for you.
We only have a few minutes left. You write that securing home care is one of the most significant challenges faced by 53+ million family caregivers. And when we wanted a break, when we were taking care of my dad, we learned that in order to bring someone in, and these people were all absolutely amazing and they deserved to be paid, you know, a living high wage, but it was $40 an hour, minimum of 3 hours. So every time we wanted to call someone in, which was actually pretty rare, it was $120. And we didn't always have 3 hours. That's just what we were facing. And, you know, former Vice President Kamala Harris had a proposal that would have required Medicare to cover long-term care at home. It got very little media attention. And here we are. We're definitely not going to get this from the people in power now. So where does that leave us with policy changes?
Yeah, I'm with you. It's such a shame that we're not able to see that move forward. So many of us, myself and my mother at the time, were shocked to learn that Medicare does not cover home health care. And the only way that you can cover the cost of home health care and employ a direct care worker in the home, like a home health aide, is either to pay out of pocket, which can become exorbitant, as you just mentioned, especially if you need, you know, more than 3 hours, or through Medicaid. And that's a hot topic right now, given what's going on. And The Medicaid system, if you do rely on Medicaid, the process, the wait times for getting onto Medicaid can be quite lengthy. I did this in New York State, where I heard the wait times are the shortest, and it took a little bit over a year. And so it's not an immediate answer. This is another one of the reasons why I encourage you to have those conversations early, because if you are a family who may need to eventually look into securing Medicare to cover the cost of home health care, it's a process to start immediately, long in advance of when it might be urgently needed. But we are in a very precarious situation right now with what's happening, and certainly it's affecting patients, caregivers, and the direct care workforce, these potential cuts to Medicaid.
I have a friend whose father bought end-of-care insurance. She said her parents hated paying into it, but she's so glad they did because her mom now needs 24/7 care, and it's $10,000 a month.
That's incredible. So there are these policies. My dad actually had a long-term care policy that he had taken out in the early 90s, but many of these policies have a cap. And have limits to them. So it sounds like what your friend has might be a little bit more generous than what my dad had, but certainly it can offset the cost of care. You know, this is another reason why those conversations are so important, because one of the topics you need to bring up, and I do have a list of question prompts for you to address this topic of the financial side of care, is what are the other assets that are available that could potentially cover the cost, and who else in the caregiving network can potentially contribute? And very importantly, you all should be asking yourself the question, how much am I personally willing to pay to take care of my father, my mother, my partner, whoever the person is? I never asked myself that question formally. I ended up spending my entire salary on my dad's care. And like so many of the caregivers in the United States, the financial repercussions of caregiving are going to last my entire lifetime. I should just say, while the value of the efforts that we perform was estimated at $600 billion, one quarter of caregivers experience high financial strain, and one-fifth go into poverty as a result of caregiving. And so talking about the financial side is so, so critical.
Yes, and we'll continue these conversations. We have many, many emails that we didn't have time for. So thank you for all of the emails. We'll continue the conversation. Others want us to do shows about end-of-life doulas and hospice and palliative care. We will definitely focus on those issues. I want to thank Dr. Allison Applebaum, our guest today, who's author of the book Stand By Me, A Guide to Navigating Modern Meaningful Caregiving. It was just released in paperback. Dr. Applebaum, thank you for your important work, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Thanks to Nina Kissinger for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show, and thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.